My name is Michael Koval Andersen and I listen to Fahrradio.
Willkommen bei Fahrradio, dem Podcast für alles, was mit Fahrrädern zu tun hat. Dies ist die Ausgabe 10, aufgenommen am 7.04.2011. Mein Name ist Hans und ich bin heute alleine bei Fahrradio. Ich bin aber nicht ganz alleine, denn ich habe ein Interview mitgebracht. Ich war auf der Fahrradmesse Velo Berlin und einen Tag vorher fand der Mobilitätskongress Metro Mobile statt. Die Keynote zum Kongress hielt Michael Colville Anderson. Sie hatte den Titel Tales from the Urban Mobile Man. Er betreibt die Sites copenhagenize.com und copenhagencyclechic.com. Nach dem Kongress haben wir uns ein wenig zu unterhalten zu Themen wie Mode und was sie mit Wahrnehmung und Respekt zu tun hat, über Vintage-Räder und warum nur wenige Menschen auf Liegerädern unterwegs sind und darüber, dass man sich entscheiden muss, was man lieber möchte, mehr Fahrräder auf den Straßen oder mehr Helme auf den Köpfen. Im Interview fällt mir auf, wie schlecht mein Englisch ist. Ich bitte darum um Entschuldigung. Nächste Woche gibt es wieder ein Gespräch mit Thomas, bei dem ich ein wenig mehr über den Kongress und die Messe berichten werde. Jetzt viel Spaß mit dem Interview. I showed my brother a video with of a talk of you for TED, TED in Copenhagen, I think. And he said, oh, that's Hugh Grant.
That's a new one, my God, Hugh Grant. Funny.
Does that irritate you?
This is strange, I think. Whatever. yeah, I think I'm just surprised. I don't know what to say. Hugh Grant. I had shorter hair then, so I mean, it wasn't Hugh Grant's known for his hair. I don't have the same hair. But, okay. It was good that he saw the video anyway. So.
Yeah, he saw it. And it was that talk about the helmet. Mm-hmm. I come back to that later. So does it help looking good in getting presentations?
Well, when I'm speaking at a presentation, I think it always helps to look presentable no matter what you're doing. It's not really a conscious decision that I've made, but when I started doing a lot of public speaking, I was just sort of showing up in my regular clothes, like, you know, a pair of jeans, a nice shirt or whatever. And then I realized, you know, a lot of the crowds that I was speaking to were, you know, cyclists, you know, who were fighting for better infrastructure and whatnot. And there was also politicians there. And I realized that, you know, I couldn't, you know, if I looked like sort of a subcultural cyclist, which I never really did, but if I went on the stage in a suit, you know, maybe the politicians in many cities, not so much in Germany or Scandinavia, but you know, in Eastern Europe and whatnot, and America, they might, you know, give me a bit more respect and listen to what they have to say, because they're used to seeing these subcultures shouting for bicycle infrastructure and whatnot. Uh-huh. And you know, politicians in suits, they don't give a shit what the grassroots think. So I thought maybe I should look more presentable on stage in a suit in order to sort of, you know, make the policymakers wake up and listen. And it has actually, I can't measure the effect, but I know that, you know, that I do get more, you know, sort of more credibility and from policymakers and whatnot when I'm standing there looking very presentable. Very funny thing today is that I thought, I had my suit with me, but I thought, wait, I'm in Germany. Now, Berlin's cool, Berlin is Berlin. But I thought, okay, you know, this is an urban mobility conference, and I've been to many of these and bicycle conferences, and it is a kind of a geeky industry. The bicycle industry are, you know, they're not cycle chic, they're cycle geek.
And I
thought, oh God, who's going to be speaking at a mobility conference? And we're in Germany where, you know, suits are also very, very popular. So I thought, no, today I'm wearing jeans and sneakers, and I have a jacket and a nice shirt on. But and sure enough, you know, everybody who's standing up there today are wearing, you know, boring suits. So in a way, if you want to bring the message across, whatever the message, you know, you have to surprise people with your clothing, break down the prejudice, and looking presentable is always a good idea. So you can't show up in sweatpants and an old t-shirt, you know, if you're trying to be with you have a blog that is a kind of a style icon blog, yeah. Street style, you know, you got to look kind of good, you know, that's kind of tied to it. You have no choice.
When you sort of
take fashion as a vehicle for cycling? Is that something that you would say is a way to make that more mainstream or to bring that to more people?
I think that yes, that's the case. And this is what the success of Cycle Chic has proved. Cycle Chic is just a phrase that I invented to describe riding bicycles in your regular clothes, your fashionable clothes, not cycling clothes, not even urban cycling clothes and all this shit that we're seeing on the market at the moment, just sort of your regular clothes that you would walk in. Because it's just a new phrase for something that has existed for 125 years. Everybody just used to wear their regular clothes, riding bikes through Berlin or Copenhagen or whatever, in 70 years ago or whatever. So it's just sort of a modern catchphrase, which we need once in a while in modern society. We got to call it something, and then people understand. And people discuss Cycle Chic. In America, what is Cycle Chic? Do I have to look like some kind of European fashionista? Is that what it is? And I always say, no, it's just dress well, and whatever that means where you're from, it doesn't matter. But it has created a whole dialogue about it, and it really is important after 40 years of branding cycling as sport or recreation and nothing else. It is super important. We've discovered over the past 3 or 4 years the art of riding a bicycle in your regular pedestrian clothes is like a radical concept now, which is bizarre because that's the way it's always been. So it is important.
Well, there is a sort of infiltration by outdoor clothes. Well, they are wearing them for practical reasons.
Mm-hmm. Most of the winter I'll wear like a nice, handsome coat. But I mean, if it's really nasty weather in Copenhagen, I'll put on my ski jacket, of course. And my ski gloves if it's that cold in snowstorm. You dress for the weather. If I was going to walk all the way down Kudam, because I'm visiting here in the middle of winter, I would have a nice warm winter jacket. If I was going to ride my bike down Kudam, then I would have the same clothes on. But a lot of people who, even in Copenhagen, if it's raining all of a sudden, most people just sort of scrunch up their shoulders and just ride through it. But a lot of people who do the regular commute, at the same time every day, they will always have rain clothes with them on their bike. And, if the forecast is for rain, you'll see a lot of people with rain suits, which is horrible, not very chic at all. But they're going to work, but if you're caught in a shower, in Copenhagen, most people just sort of, will stop under a tree and wait or something, but so there are practical solutions, and that's fine. But it was cold yesterday. No, it's a nice day. But I mean, in the evening it got kind of cold, and I rode all around Berlin for 3 hours, and saw very little bicycle gear or practical, winter jackets or whatever. Most people are just going home from work, right? And so I think Germany understands. Germany has never really forgotten the bicycle. It hasn't missed an entire generation like it has in America and whatnot. Germany's never really lost touch with the bicycle, and so it's easier for people to get back onto it now.
I am a gear geek. Do you mean there's room for or a need for improvement on city bikes?
Like I don't
looking for rain protection against rain or something, like if I had a scooter. If you take a Vespa that shields away the rain.
We already have those. You get a thing on your handles. On your handlebars, where you put your hand inside, but they're attached to the bike. You see these in Japan. In the three great mainstream bicycle cultures in the world, it's Denmark, the Netherlands, and Japan. Mm. And everybody forgets Japan, but I mean, they're way ahead of a lot of countries. And they're really good at practical solutions, much more.
They invented the pedelec as well.
We still like them anyway, but... But they have, the contraptions they have for transporting children. I mean, it's amazing what kind of solutions they found. It's hard to reinvent the bicycle. It's hard to improve on it. My God, I mean, seriously, 125 years. There are tens of thousands of people who have tried, if not more, you know, the Germans, I mean, you guys, you know, the bicycle, it's good, it's effective, but can it be even more efficient? This classic German mentality, which is great, technology-based, you know, and then you guys invented the recumbent back in the 1920s, right? And, you know, why has this not caught on anywhere else in the world? Why has the recumbent not become mainstream? Because it's really just a German thing. And there's a big club in Holland as well. There's a club in Denmark as well, but like, I'm fascinated why the recumbent has never caught on. It's hard to improve upon the bicycle, and now with technology, we can see that so many people are trying. My God, the shit that's out there now. And you know what? Who's using it? Nobody. You know, in mainstream bicycle cultures, there's nobody using it, you know. In Copenhagen, for example, you know, you ask anybody, you know, how many kilometers do you ride to work every day? You know, and nobody will tell you. Nobody has a clue how many fucking kilometers. What's your average speed? Nobody knows. Nobody cares. They know their route, you know, and they know that, you know, oh, I better leave now because it takes 20 minutes, you know, and oh, I better speed up here so I'll catch the green light up there. You know, this is the kind of, you know, and there's nothing that technology that, you know, that can replace that. There's no technology that can replace that. That's sort of the human aspect of it, you know. Oh, shit, I know this red light. I better speed up now. You know, I don't need an iPhone. There was MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're trying to do a pilot program with the city of Copenhagen about some kind of an iPhone app or some kind of contraption on the bicycle that would send you a signal if one of your friends was in nearby, you know, and, like, you know, in Copenhagen, my God, you know, do I need that? No, if I want to call my friend, you know, I'll call him. I don't need to know that he's two blocks away because I'm probably on my way to somewhere practical. It might work in cities where there's, you know, a real subculture of cyclists who would like to hook up with each other and stuff, you know, like a little tribal group. That's fine. But like in the mainstream culture, I mean, you know, a lot of this technology is completely superfluous. We don't need it. So that's why that's why vintage bikes are so incredibly popular. People are just going right back to the basics. You know, I just got a vintage bike from the mid-1950s at home. First off, no.
No.
Okay. I just got a Swedish bike from the mid-1950s last week. It has a handle on the down tube, on the seat tube.
I saw that on your blog.
You know, where the fuck is that? Why isn't, you know, it'll, now, I blogged about it. You can be sure that some bike
brands. The ladies' bicycles in Holland, in the Netherlands, they have a handle.
Have you seen a lot of them? Okay.
No. It's just the frame.
Yeah,
you can grab the frame.
Yeah, it's a perfect height.
And my daughter has a ladies' bike, a little ladies' bike, and it has a double frame, but you can't grab it because the chain guard is right there.
Yeah.
So it's silly.
Yeah.
Nobody paid attention.
No.
But if you have a stair, you have to carry the bike up there or down.
Yep.
And the handle is great. It's a nice idea.
I mean, there's a reason it was there. Yeah. There was a reason it was on bikes for many decades. You know, it wasn't just like one bike that was a funny idea. It had a practical function. So anyway, we're going to see that come back on some brands, I bet, now. But, you know, we've tried. It's really fascinating. Look at all the, you know, the car industry, look at how we've tried to improve cars. They still look the same. Well, they look a bit different, but I mean, generally they look the same. And now you look at cars in the 60s.
They can flex their car mirrors now.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Oh my God, that's fantastic. You know, and more fuel efficient, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But like, it's still just a car.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe you have to do less. It automatically locks, you know, it's all electronic now. But really, it's still just a car, and it still does the same thing, and it's like the bicycle, you know, and even more simplistic. So, like I said, in 1900 and 1910 and all that, there were lots of crazy shit that there were people were trying to sell to capitalize on the boom. They disappear from the history books, and this is what we'll see with, you know, people selling urban cycling trousers. You know, they look like real trousers, but you can ride a bike in them. My God, how have we managed for 125 years without that?
Seen those, and my finger was about right above the order button.
Okay.
I don't know why. What they look good.
Yeah. But I mean,
I mean, they were from cotton. They weren't really. They had like a Velcro fastener or something like that. Yeah. But you can make them tighter.
I mean, a lot of them are fine. You know, they're funny ideas, but they're never going to be mainstream. You know, they were never. You know, so.
Some friends of mine, they made a conference lately called Cognitive Cities, where they talked about smart cities and thinking cities, and people from Nokia were there and showed maps of where people were moving, and there are those concepts where you can locate potholes and send to your to your city, like tell them this needs to be fixed, or fix my road, I think is some one of those problems.
We have one in Denmark, in Copenhagen as well.
Yeah.
Same thing.
And those open data initiatives, is there anything in those movements that can help cycling?
I don't know, to be honest. I can't see any personally, I can't see what I would use any of that for, but data is great, you know. Data is important in working towards improving, you know, city life. So I can't see any function in it personally, but I know that somebody will, you know, and maybe there'll be a whole bunch of overcomplication, but I'm sure at some point the data will be important. I think it's great, you know, and it's also fun, you know.
Yeah, that's a part of it, yes.
I've been trying to work on a project. Well, I had an idea, basically, where I think it was the World Cup in Germany, where there was some company. They had a map of Berlin online, and you could, and based on mobile signals, you could see where parties were, which squares were partying, and that was really kind of cool, like a pulse map of mobile signals. But it'd be cool in Copenhagen or in another city just to map, you know, to design the program where. You know, we know that bicycles on average drive about 16 kilometers per hour in Copenhagen. So you say, right, anything moving that fast is a bicycle. Anything moving slower, there's a pedestrian, faster, that's a car. And then just being able to see the whole traffic move and just see the visualization live every day of people's mobile signals. We have some privacy issues in Denmark. I don't think it's actually possible to do this, but it would be.
And then there's, I've been part in subcultures like, I rode BMX, I was a mountain biker, I once had a recumbent bicycle, but it's over, I'm over there.
You grew up.
Do you think that hurts cycling, or that makes people like sort of stand back and makes them feel like they don't belong to that, those are not my people, why can't they as well, like, do I have to be like them to ride on the street?
Yeah, well, most people don't want to be members of a subculture, or if they do, it's you know, they have their group of friends, you know, and that's, you know, and nobody wants, you know, very few regular Homo sapiens want to stand up on a soapbox, you know, we prefer to blend in. This is just part of human nature. We're a flock animals, right? And that's how we function. So people who are in these various subcultures, you know, I often compare the cycling subcultures to stamp collectors, you know, completely passionate about stamps, my God.
Fishing
as well, my God. And that's cool, you know, people need hobbies, and if they have a passion, all respect for that. What is a bit of a challenge is that the cycling subcultures, you know, there's focus on cycling. They want better conditions for cycling in cities. So, you know, they have been until very recently, the singular voice for bicycle advocacy. And when a subculture starts saying they want something, that's not good for the mainstream. There are a very few examples of subcultures who have merged well with sort of mainstream bicycle advocates. Hungary is a great example. Budapest, they had a strong subculture, and the Hungarian Cyclists Association, they both sort of had a happy marriage, and they started a cycle sheet blog, the Bicycle Association, and so they just have sort of a real harmony. It's just everybody for the bicycle, which is really gives them more political power, you know, that there's some guys in suits and some, you know, homies on bikes, but, you know, it has more credibility, where in many countries, like in America, you know, it's all the subcultures doing all the yapping, and, you know, a lot of them don't want any bicycle infrastructure, you know, they only want to ride on roads, and these, you know, that's like 1% of the population, so what about the other 99 who want to ride safe on infrastructure, you know? So I've seen there's been I've seen a lot of, at least the last 2 years, kind of a backlash, mostly in America, but from the cycling subcultures, of this new craze, you know. I mean, letters, you know, to the editor, you know, I've been cycling for 20 years, and now all these wobbly fashionistas on their upright bikes, you know, somebody's going to get killed if they ride dangerously, you know. And there's a, you know, all of a sudden, that's a lot of the cyclists from before, they think it's great that more people are cycling, you know, that's good for everybody. But there is a group of them that that they find that we're infiltrating their subculture. You know, if we all started showing up at stamp collecting meetings, you know, the stamp collectors were saying, who the fuck are these people? You know, I've been stamp collecting for 20 years, and now all of a sudden they're interested in stamps. You know, and so it is a problem in some places, and it's solved in other places. But, you know, subcultures have never in history been very good at marketing anything to the mainstream. So this is what we have to watch out about.
There's one thing which I consider subculture, that's those critical mass events. What do you think of those critical mass?
I wrote an article on Copenhagenize about 3 years ago.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. But I mean, I say critical miss or critical mass, where I criticize it. It doesn't win any hearts and minds in the way that it's performed in many cities, mostly in America. It started in San Francisco, and San Francisco really is the Berlin of America. It's kind of a funky town. You can do crazy ass shit like that. And then it started spreading around to other cities where it was, you know, really not very well received. And it is a subculture, you know, protesting, yeah, basically. And if a driver is on his way home, you know, for dinner to his family, and the bridge is blocked by these, you know, these strange-looking people, if you think about, like, you know, he can't reflect himself in them, you know, we're not winning any hearts and minds. We're not converting him to be a cyclist, which is the goal of mainstreaming all this. So it is very, very, you know, in-your-face approach. The way that it's been done, but a lot of people, and so I don't, you know, it's bad marketing for cycling. Mm-hmm. But then there's a lot of places that have just adjusted it. They called it critical mass in Prague, and now they call it something else. I think it's just bicycle ride in Czech, because they didn't want to associate themselves with, yeah, critical mass. It's a bad brand. In Budapest, they call it critical mass, but it's you know, it's the people. It's like, you know, between 20 and 80,000. I think the record is 80,000 in the critical mass in Budapest, mm-hmm, a couple of years ago. I was in one last year with 20,000 people. It's amazing. It's just regular, lots of roadies and shit, but it's also like, you know, just regular people going for a bike ride. And that's positive, you know. And then you see it in America. They sort of have that more, you know, aggressive subcultures, which you know, are really shooting themselves in the foot and screwing up everything for the rest of us. But so if you do it right, like a celebration of the bicycle, you know, then you're going to win hearts and minds. If you you piss off motorists and are aggressive, you're not.
Then there's that the thing that whatever means of transport you're using, you change your personality. If you're in a car, you have a pedal and you push on it and you're fast and cyclists are in the way. Mm. If you're on a bicycle, pedestrians are in the way.
Yeah.
And if you're if you're a pedestrian and you have a pram, well, cars again are, yeah, in, yeah, the way.
Well, actually, mothers with prams, you know, if you're a pedestrian, it's the mothers with prams you have to watch out for, yeah, in Copenhagen. I mean, like, God, they're like tanks, you know? Yeah, I mean, yeah, there is a hierarchy, and pedestrians are always, you know, at the bottom of it and have been for, you know, since bicycles and cars were invented. I think solving the problem is getting more regular people on, you know, onto bicycles, more mainstream. You know, if I cycling around in New York, you know, I was seriously the only person in New York that day stopping at red lights on a bicycle, you know, and but I did it anyway because I thought that's sending positive messaging. More regular people on the bikes, you know, the more people who obey the very basic etiquette rules, traffic rules in a city, you know, and at no point riding around for 3 hours yesterday was I worried about cars. It was really like being in Copenhagen in that sense. I trusted the German drivers and the German driving training, which is just as intense as it is in Denmark. You know, it takes a long time, costs a lot of money to get a license. Wow, it was really a calming effect. Some taxis, and that's the problem. Copenhagen is taxis, blowing down the bus lanes. But generally, it was a good, you know, I was never, it was really quite a nice experience when I was in bus lanes and stuff. So more people onto bicycles, more regular people, and then, you know, the very simple etiquette falls into play. If you have a job, you're nice to your coworkers, even if you don't like them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, and it's so easy just to be pissed off at a machine with just a glimpse of a person, right? And it's easy to sit in a car and think the whole world's against you. This is simple. This is all over the world. But I mean, you know, regular people generally, you know, all the people I was riding around Berlin with yesterday, you know, we all stopped at red lights. couple of people blew through. I blew through a couple of red lights when there was no cars and no pedestrians on a narrow street, you know, where there's no cross traffic. I mean, yeah, of course, easy. But I mean, you just be civilized. Like, it's like they're your roommates or your job mates, right? The more regular people on the, you know, citizen cyclists, the easier it becomes, you know. There's still people bitching about, you know, cyclists in Copenhagen. They've been doing it for 125 years and they're still going on and on about it. But, you know, it's not a problem. You know, visitors who come to Copenhagen, you know, from other countries, go, oh my God, how well behaved. Everybody stops for the red lights and everybody is just rides nice and easy and takes care. And it's true, you know, really, if you look at it. But if you're living there, you know, it's like, oh, they're taking over the world, those bikes. It's usually old people who complain, right? But anyway, so.
Okay. Last question, helmets. Should I wear one? Should I? Should there be? Should it be mandatory? Is it safe? Safer than riding without?
That's a lot of questions. If wearing a helmet keeps you on a bike, that's great. If not wearing a helmet keeps you on a bike, that's great. That's what it's all about. That's the official response from Copenhagen. But with that said, I mean, the ADFC here in Germany, cyclist federations all around Europe, I mean, they are against promotion of helmets. They are completely against mandatory helmet laws, because all of this makes it look like cycling is more dangerous than it is, and we cannot afford to have people stop cycling. We need to have a lot more people cycling, and we've seen from all over the world that promotion of helmets and helmet laws, fewer people cycle. Then there's the whole technical ball game. Is there anywhere in the world where helmets have been proven to help? A helmet is not designed to save lives. A helmet is designed for a fall, simulating me as a pedestrian falling and bumping my head. Helmets are not even tested for impact on the sides or the front or the back, only on a really lovely little circle right on the crown of your head. So they're not tested with a body in them. So, like, you know, they just smash a helmet down onto in the laboratory, fine. But if you have 80 kilograms of body twisting and turning, they don't test it for that. So it really is a follow the money question over the past 20 years. There's good money in it from the American companies who make them. You know, so it's a hornet's nest, really. I just think that at the end of the day, when there's no conclusive scientific proof, there's some proof that says they help, there's some that say that doesn't. When there's no conclusive scientific proof, we shouldn't be promoting anything at all. Especially when we risk scaring people off of the bike. You know, Australia, with their mandatory, their promotion and then their mandatory laws, they killed off regular people on bicycles.
But I mean, for sports, it's okay.
I don't give a shit what people do in sports. it's risk perception, you know. If you're going to go mountain biking, you know, yeah, there's a lot of branches hanging there, so you might want to protect your head against some smacks on the head, right? I just think it's, you know, people knowing about what helmets are designed to do and their limitations as well. I mean, there's studies that show you have a higher risk of brain injury with a helmet on. You have 14% greater chance of getting into an accident with a helmet on because you feel overprotected. So you drive a bit crazy, ride a bit crazier. Then there's other ones that say, yeah, that's great, you know. There's no conclusive evidence, so let's just promote cycling. I really believe that we can promote helmets or we can promote cycling, but we cannot do both. And I've made my choice about what I want to promote. I want to promote cycling. So, you know, do what you want, but I think it's just really important to know both sides of the issue. Informing the public is not a bad thing.